Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. With another school year underway, it's the perfect time to replay one of my all-time favorite morning show conversations on the critical matter of education, and especially the matter of education in our public schools. It is a topic about which there is tremendous interest and passion and plenty of difference of opinion as well. And it is a topic about which we often struggle to have truly meaningful conversations and truly effective dialogue. One of the best books I have ever read on the topic of education is by Mike Rose, professor at UCLA in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. Mike Rose drew upon 40 years of teaching and research experience in order to write his wonderful book called Why School? Reclaiming Education for All of Us. Mike Rose's previous books on the topic included Possible Lives, The Promise of Public Education in America, Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education, Lives on the Boundary, The Struggles and Achievements of America's Underprepared, and a book about which I did a morning show interview, The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker. This book, once again, published in 2009 by The New Press, is titled Why School? Reclaiming Education for All of Us. I'm sure, after having read your book, I know that you have to agree with me in what I'm saying about how our discourse about education feels really ineffective for all the people that are talking about it. It seems like we are, I don't know, talking around it or just talking about it in ways that just don't feel effective. What is going wrong, not even so much with education, but in the way that we're trying to address education issues in our country?
Boy, that is a good question. And first of all, you know, gosh, Greg, the conversation has become so polemical, right? It has, as you indicated, people are talking past each other so often, and folks dig in their heels. And so one problem is, I think, just the conversation, as so many other political conversations these days, has become very polarized. So that's an issue for sure. But I think something else, too, is that I'm not sure we as a nation, and certainly not at the policy level, I'm not sure we appreciate just what a complex, delicate thing teaching somebody is. I mean, education is very complex business. And unfortunately, we tend to look for magic bullets. And I think that creates another problem with our discourse, as you say, but also with some of the solutions that we try to mount, so that we look for that one big thing. You know, people in policy circles and in philanthropies talk about finding the lever. You know, what's the lever we're going to find, that this one thing that we're going to be able to do that's going to, as they say, move the needle or be a game changer? And I just don't think education, just like curing a disease or something, some other kind of very complex problem, I just don't think it's that easy. But we keep looking for the magic cure. Is the magic cure going to be a mathematical way to evaluate teachers? Or is it going to be a set of standardized tests? Or is it going to be a set of standards? Or is it going to be charter schools? Or is it going to be, you know, whatever the next bright, shiny object is? And I think that helps create some of the problems that you're talking about.
In your first chapter, actually, as you talk about the need for us to, in a sense, find new language or just find new ways to, first of all, to just approach education, even before we start trying to solve its problems, to just sort of talk about it and understand what it's about. You point out, I think, quite rightly, that the vast majority of conversations that occur about education are couched in terms that are so clinical and kind of business-driven or bottom-line-driven, and we miss out on a rich array of other possibilities in terms of talking about what real education means, what education is at its heart. Can you say a word about what the most important things that we are missing here?
Yeah, it's so true. Like if you sat down and read just a whole slew of political speeches and opinion columns over the last couple decades, you would walk away thinking that the sole purpose of education in the United States is to help people enter the economic order. Now, look, I'm a child of the working class, and education made mobility possible for me. So I am not in the least looking my nose down upon the economic reasons that we send kids to school or that we go back to school ourselves. But education in the United States, I mean, in a democratic society, should be about so much more. And there's other times in our history when it was about so much more, at least in, you know, the way it was discussed. So just think about it. Parents send their kids to school, of course, to gain the kind of skills so that they'll be self-sufficient economically, of course. But they also send their kids to school to develop socially, to learn how to think with other kids, to learn how to learn, to learn how to solve problems, to develop interests, to become decent people, to think, to deliberate, to learn history and learn how to learn from it, to speak up. I mean, gosh, there's so many other reasons that we send kids to school in a democratic society. And what's interesting, Greg, what is really interesting to me is that when I've talked at length with people, with adults who are coming back to school, and these are often folks who have not had an easy time of it, they're coming back to school for very explicit economic reasons. They want to get a leg up in a difficult economy. Even there, the reasons tend to fan out once you talk a little bit, so that they're coming back to school also because they just want to feel their minds working again. They want to be able to help their kids with school. They want to get better at reading and writing or mathematics. They want to learn new things. So even amongst a population that is explicitly focused on the economic motive for returning to school, even there you get this range of reasons. And none of that enters into the public conversation over the last decade or two. The reason that's a problem is because it, as you mentioned a moment ago, it kind of restricts our sense of what schooling is about. And what's dangerous about that is that if something's not talked about, it can slip away from focus, so that schools start to focus on narrower and narrower goals, like making sure that those tests of basic math and reading get a few bumps in the point scale. So my worry is that if we don't talk about these things, if they're not part of the public discourse, then they fade away from the curriculum and they fade away from our attention.
One of the interesting points you make in this chapter about language and the language and rhetoric we embrace to talk about education is when you talk about the shallow way in which we often use the word opportunity. And I think this speaks very much to what you were just saying, the fact that in America, our culture, in that sense of the American dream, is to a large extent built around this notion of opportunity. But it's so much more than what we tend to focus on in current conversations about education.
Right. And when I think about opportunity in school, and, you know, I think about this, certainly, gosh, I've been doing this work for 40 years, so I've talked to an awful lot of folks, and I've seen a lot of teachers in a lot of classrooms. But I also think about my own time through school, and it seems to me that one really important thing about opportunity is the feeling of opportunity, the sense of opportunity. And when you look at good classrooms and you look at teaching that goes well and you talk to children who are in schools that are decent and with teachers who they like, you realize that opportunity is this sense they have of promise, of a future, of you know, even that just what they're doing day to day is enjoyable and matters and makes them feel good and teaches them things. So little kids will say things like, you know, our teacher is teaching us things we didn't know how to do before, or our teacher doesn't fuss very much. This is a nice place to be. Or math will get you a long ways in life, right? Just all kinds of statements that indicate that they are not only being blessed in that they have opportunity, but that they're experiencing it. And it's a powerful thing to experience. It gives you a sense that there's something that sits in front of you. And I think especially for low-income kids, that can be hugely powerful.
I'm breathing deeply because there are so many different ways to go in this, just this simple conversation we're having about your wonderful book. And in a sense, I feel like just openly acknowledging that, because in a sense that underscores one of the first points you made, that we tend not to, even on the most basic level, appreciate the complexity of what we're talking about when we talk about public education and education in general. And in a sense, that helps explain perhaps this tendency that we have as citizens and our policymakers have as well to gravitate towards simplistic ideas, simplistic summaries of what it's all about, and simplistic solutions to complex problems. I mean, the alternative is to dive into the full complexity of it, which is scary for all of us. Even those of us who are involved in education have to find that, especially in this complicated world in which we live, very intimidating.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. You know, one of the reasons that we gravitate toward simple answers to things is just what you said. I mean, we do this in our daily lives. It's not just in education, right? We do gravitate toward the simpler explanation for things because it makes life easier. It makes a blooming, buzzing universe less confusing. But I think we do so at our peril with so many major kinds of problems. I mean, whether it's agricultural development or healthcare or, in this case, education. So maybe the challenge, I hadn't thought about it quite this way, Greg, but maybe the challenge is trying to figure out how we find some kind of middle point to navigate where we realize that, yes, we do have to come up with some answers to things, but that we try our best to make sure that those answers at least begin to match the complexity of what we're talking about. For that to happen, I think we really need something that we don't see happening a lot in education policy circles these days, and that is we have to really listen to people who are close on the ground. We have to get in close to where the action is. We have to spend lots of time sitting in schools and looking at classrooms and talking to teachers. And unfortunately, policy, so, and especially in this age that kind of gravitates toward technocratic and managerial solutions, that policy tends to operate at a kind of 30,000-foot level, right? So that kind of basic on-the-ground knowledge that so many people have about schools kind of gets washed out of the equation, and that pushes our solutions then more toward these kind of simple magic bullet one-shot answers to more complex questions.
I'm also reminded, as we think about the complexity of some of these questions and the perplexing problems that face education, I'm struck by the image that is on the cover of your book. For those of our listeners who haven't yet seen your book, describe the cover and why that's sort of an intriguing image given what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, it's an iconic little photograph of a one-room schoolhouse, which, you know, just has so much symbolism in the United States, I think. I mean, you know, there was a time when there were something like 200,000 of these little one-room, single-teacher schools dotted all across the country. And it's what, through the 19th and into the early 20th century, it's what created a high level of literacy and numeracy amongst the population. There's still a few of them left, by the way. There's like 300 or 400 one-room schoolhouses or single-teacher schoolhouses still in operation. But that image, it gives rise to lots of romantic kinds of thoughts. It gives rise to sentimentality and all of that. But it also, I think, represents, and this is what I hope it represents on the cover of the book, it represents this kind of fundamental role that education plays in a democracy and the promise of education. And again, I just think that some of that spirit has been bled out of, it's drained away from our policy talk these days. We don't hear that kind of language.
Right. As I saw that beautiful image, and I should add, it's also a one-room schoolhouse set against a cloudless sky, so which also gives us this idyllic picture of once upon a time. But when I saw that beautiful photograph of that one-room schoolhouse, I also was reminded of a conversation I recorded not long ago with a woman in our community, a retired music teacher who just turned 100 years old, institution amongst our education and music landscape here in Southeast Wisconsin. And her first job was teaching in a one-room schoolhouse in northern Wisconsin, where she had to help scoop the coal into the furnace and this and that. But as we sort of talked about that, you also came away with this sense that for as simple as that looks, I mean, it looks like something from Little House on the Prairie, there's something incredibly complicated about one teacher in a school with all of these different aged students and finding out a way for everybody to have an effective education. And I suspect in some places it happened beautifully and probably in other one-room schoolhouses not so well. But there's kind of a lesson to be learned even there in not drawing too many idyllic inferences from a pretty photograph.
Yeah, you know, that... We do have a tendency to maybe everyone does, but I know that in our country we do have a tendency to look back to golden ages, right? We construct or we create this as you say, this idyllic sort of sense of what things used to be like. And the one room school was a remarkable institution, and just as you said, there are stories that just sound awful, and there's other stories that sound just remarkable. And when you read the letters that some of these teachers wrote, they contain that mix of both extraordinary hardship and challenge, as well as this sense of promise and hope. It's in the book there. I talk a bit about the one-room schoolhouse toward the end and just what it represents. And in there, I quote a little bit of, you know, some sections from letters like that or people's reminiscences of the one-room schoolhouse. And again, just as you said, they range all the way from like, oh my God, this sounds horrible, to something that's really kind of edifying and remarkable, a remarkable institution.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today with Mike Rose about his book, Why School? Reclaiming Education for All of Us. There are a couple of important issues and questions which we should try to address. One of them is the issue of poverty and the fact that widespread poverty in the United States is a very powerful factor in how education is delivered, how it is experienced, the kind of deficits with which many students walk into the classroom before the business of education has even begun. And from what you write in your book, we clearly have not fully come to terms with this yet, or certainly a segment of folks engaged in conversations about education do not seem to fully realize the importance, the important role, the unfortunate role that poverty plays in our public education system.
Right, and it's my gosh, what a topic this is. We know, we've got more research than you can put in a library that demonstrates that the single biggest factor in determining a child's achievement in school is the income of his parents, period. I mean, it's just been overwhelmingly demonstrated for decades and decades and decades, the correlation between parental income and a child's achievement. So it's a big issue, and it becomes an even bigger issue, I think, when you realize, as you said, the kind of the rising levels of income inequality in our country. I mean, we are the most, in terms of income inequality, we rank at the top of developed Western nations. So, and it's getting worse. And so, of course, that's going to affect achievement. There's a debate. I don't even know if debate is the word I want, but there's a mindset that has settled into school reform circles over the last decade or so, and that is that poverty shouldn't matter. That is that if you have really good teachers, if you have a school that's functioning well, that is going to be the counterbalance for poverty. You hear the president say zip code doesn't matter or shouldn't matter. Someone's zip code shouldn't matter. No Child Left Behind, that legislation, one of the hallmark characteristics of it was that, essentially to say that schooling and a particular kind of schooling could be a counterbalance to poverty, could overcome poverty. So in a sense, we're looking at school as our major anti-poverty program. Now, what's troubling to me about that is that it, again, simplifies something that is more complex. We seem to have a difficult time understanding two things at the same time. One is poverty places a real drag on achievement for all the reasons we know. I mean, just simply think of what it would mean if all kids had good eyeglasses, right? That alone is going to affect a young child's ability to read. So poverty matters. Poverty is a drag on achievement. On the other hand, that cannot serve as an excuse for not trying to do the very best you can, for putting the best teachers in classrooms with low-income kids, for doing everything possible to create rich curricula for them. And the thing is, Greg, we can't seem to understand that both of those things are true at the same time. So we either have folks saying, listen, yeah, we know kids are poor, but it shouldn't matter. And then we have other folks who say, well, there's really nothing I can do in this classroom because my kids are so poor. Neither one of those positions are the accurate and correct one. The right one is to say both of these things are true. We do our best to do what we can do to create a good education for kids, but at the same time we keep in mind that poverty matters and we do everything we can, in terms of public policy, in terms of just making our voices heard, we do everything we can to make sure that people don't forget the fact that a lot of these kids are poor and that affects achievement.
You say that there is something very tempting about that mantra of no excuse. There are no excuses, maybe explanations, but no excuses. And this sense that we simply must place these stringent demands on everybody, and and allow people the opportunity to rise to those expectations. But then you say in the wake of that, in acknowledging that there's probably something to be said for that notion of no excuses, but you say it is naive or duplicitous to dismiss the devastating effects of poverty on a child's life in school. I'm just curious, as you say that so well, do you think it's more one or the other? I mean, is it really people being naive and ignorant, or is there something more sinister at play when people are so dismissive of the plight of poor children when it comes to education and achievement?
Well, gosh, I think it depends. Here it really depends on who's saying it, right? I mean, there's a lot of different players out there in this whole school reform business today, and they range all the way from folks who have very conservative notions about public education and would essentially like to see it dismantled and privatized. And then you go all the way over to the other side, where you've got folks who I think are really well-intentioned and want to preserve public education, but are very disturbed by the very real fact that there's lots of kids, many of them poor, who are getting terrible educations, and they're trying to think of ways to intervene, even though I disagree with some of the interventions. So there's a lot of players out there with a lot of different motives. So I don't think we can, you know, just attribute it to one set of goals or motives. But again, I get back to that point that this is just such a wrong-headed kind of debate to say there's no excuses. There's no excuses that can be made for poverty. You still kids can still achieve and schools can do good things. And we don't want to hear anything about poverty. And that versus no, poverty is the overwhelming thing and there's really not much we can do. The answer lies in some complicated kind of middle, difficult terrain where you keep the public's eye on poverty and the terrible effects poverty has on schooling, all the while that you continue to do the very best you can do to teach the kids who are in front of you. Now, to do that often means that poverty has to be acknowledged. So that, for example, we create schools that have what they call wraparound services, right? So if schools are in really poor neighborhoods, in addition to really to trying to create really good classrooms and good teaching and that, do we also have health care available? Do we also have social services to help parents who need help with housing or with their finances? Do we have a school that stays open late so that the kids have some place to go and be that's safe with adults around? That seems to me to be the way we begin to resolve this silly binary debate. That is, how do we do our best to teach in the most effective and powerful way possible, but in a setting that acknowledges poverty and provides resources to help children and parents deal with the fact that they're really up against it.
You devote a considerable amount of your book, not surprisingly, to programs like No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, and to this whole notion that the quality of education delivered should be based upon what is found in standardized testing. At one point, you say that that one of the problems with these kind of programs is what you describe as an accountability mechanism that might restrict their full realization. Mm-hmm. That is, in this struggle to make schools and those who teach in them more accountable, we set up a scenario in which that becomes harder to do, or for those goals set out in plain black and white to ultimately be achieved. What would you say would be a tangible example of that?
Yeah, well, there certainly were a lot under No Child Left Behind, for sure. That we have research that demonstrates that this push for the accountability on these two measures, the reading and mathematics tests, that that ended up really constricting curriculum in a lot of schools. That is, teachers focused so much on those tests because the stakes were so high that other kinds of subjects ranging from music and art to even science ended up getting short shrift. So that certainly undercuts a rich education for those kids. But we have an even more recent example. You know, there's all the talk about Common Core standards now, and people are trying to roll out these new standards that have more focus on, creating a more challenging curriculum, more problem solving, more application of knowledge, that sort of thing. And regardless of what you think of those standards, everybody on all sides of the spectrum of beliefs about the legitimacy of those standards, everybody was worried about what was going to happen when the accountability tests kicked in. And there were so many people, testing experts included, who were warning states and districts to hold off on those accountability measures, hold off on the tests until we can get this new, very different kind of curriculum in place, get teachers used to it, have the right kind of professional development. Well, as one could predict, the push for accountability for this testing business got so amped up that we're already starting to see some states try and give tests that are not well constructed and not well thought out for these standards that people haven't even had a chance to accommodate to, and the results are disastrous. So even if you think that the Common Core had a lot of good to it, it's being undercut by this push toward, you know, let's get the numbers. And so I think there's a real tension here between this push toward a kind of narrow sort of accountability that you can count and measure versus an accountability that would be more richly based in the idea that teaching and learning is complex and takes time and involves human beings and involves a learning curve and involves a lot of rich development, both on the parts of teachers and students. These two notions just clash, and that's what we're seeing happening with Common Core in its early stages.
Right. In the chapter in which you talk about the pervasive influence of the business world in the education world, you talk about this in a couple of ways. One of them is in the way that principals both see themselves and tend to carry out their duties more as school executives, educational engineers. I mean, going about what they do in very different fashion. Can you just say a word about maybe the most significant ways in which this sometimes happens now, and what kind of influence that has on the situation?
Yeah. So you know, if you think of the word principal, I mean, the original meaning is that the person was the principal teacher in the school. Somebody who provided guidance, who provided supervision, who provided, some wisdom about teaching. And, you know, by and large, we've kind of moved very far away from that model, partly because there are so many rules and regulations now that, you know, the principal's desk is just filled with paperwork dealing with compliance. But also the kinds of models that have emerged as to what leadership should look like and what school administration should look like. There's, unfortunately, this kind of business orientation is a predominant one right now. There's others, but the business one certainly predominates. And on the part of a lot of the school reformers, it really does dominate. So that, superintendents in some cities are called CEOs, right? The CEOs of a school rather than superintendent or the head of the school. So this kind of business model has dominated. Now, there's a lot of parts about running a school or running a district that do involve business kinds of decisions, and business acumen would be sorely needed. But it has just tended to wash away any sense of this, of the principal as a person who should really be thinking hard and long about teaching and curriculum and how to make a school work really like a school. I don't know how we dial that back exactly, given how far down this road we've gotten and how many real demands there are on principals that have to do with legal and business and compliance kinds of things. But I don't think it's a healthy model.
Right. You also, as you're in the wake of describing that, return to the matter of language in a way that I found quite intriguing when you say that, our current-day schools, especially those that fully embrace the most common notions of education reform, tend to adopt what you call a technocratic language that sounds precise, definitive, and action-oriented. We will incentivize, scale up, and move the needle. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting, I mean, because this sounds so familiar, and I think of every time somebody gets elected to the school board, or particularly when somebody gets selected as the new superintendent, I mean, so often that is the entirety of their rhetoric is contained in that kind of model.
Boy, I know it makes you just wish for George Orwell to be around these days, thinking about the way he wrote about politics in the English language, right? That seems to be the only vocabulary that a lot of school folks have. I mean, whatever happened to talking about creativity and learning and kids discovering things and running up against barriers, running up against failure, learning how to fail, learning from failure. There's just so many other words that represent the full range of what it means to learn and to grow and to develop socially and cognitively and emotionally. And man, you're going to be hard pressed.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
The shallow way in which we tend to think about the matter of intelligence, mm-hmm. and of the role that education plays in the formation of one's intelligence, and for that matter, the question of what kind of intelligence matters most in the world in which we live versus the world we lived in 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
Right.
How would you have us think about the notion of intelligence differently than we tend to now?
Right. I think, you know, for all the talk that there is about intelligence, and we're talking about it all the time, especially in this high-tech era, right, I think we operate with a pretty narrow notion of it. I mean, our ideas about intelligence are kind of based on, informed by the IQ test or the traditional school task. So, And I don't want to deny for a minute that if somebody does well on something like an IQ test or does well on a traditional school task, that that indicates some kind of smarts. Of course it does. Absolutely. But think of all the everyday manifestations of intelligence that kind of more narrow definition misses. So think of the plumber working on an old house, and he cuts a little hole in the wall and has to reach up behind the wall to feel the pipes that he can't see. And based on what he's feeling, he's visualizing what he's feeling, and then he's making judgments, diagnostic judgments, based on what he feels. Or think of the hairstylist, right, who's sitting there and her client comes in and the client flops down and she says, man, I don't know, just give me something light and summery. And the stylist, through a series of questions, through gestures, through maybe using pictures from magazines, through looking in the mirror with the client, comes to some kind of a decision about a style that's going to satisfy this very vague and poetic kind of request. So these kinds of examples of people thinking and solving problems and troubleshooting and using their mind and applying knowledge, these are all around us, but they would be missed by most tests that you could give people. So that's what I mean when I say we operate with this kind of narrow notion about what it means to be smart. And I think that has bad consequences, both for education, but also for how we live with each other. You know, we make pretty consequential judgments about each other based on our perception of people's intelligence. And sometimes we make that judgment based on the kind of work they do, or or how verbal they might be, how orally verbal they might be. And there's just so many other ways to determine, to just see evidence of smarts. Mm. And I think we miss out on it. Mm.
Of course, one of the most sobering realities about public education is the fact that essentially the doors are open to everyone. That's part of the whole point of it. Mm-hmm. But because of that, we end up then with many situations that are almost inescapably rather turbulent, because you have people sometimes of widely differing backgrounds and classes and so on, thrust together into situations that that can be uncomfortable, and especially, of course, you are sometimes talking about the presence of people who, for one reason or another, have not ever really learned to behave or to listen or to function well with others in these kind of settings. What is your wisest advice about confronting this vexing aspect of public education?
Well, as a society, obviously, we have made decisions, and this has been written into law, right, that we will accept all children and that we will make accommodations as best we can to satisfy their needs. And sometimes that involves a significant amount of expense. But it is what we as a society have decided we want to do. And that's, I think, a democratic impulse. That you know, we're not going to lock certain kids away or keep kids in the attic. That school is going to be open to all children. Now that brings with it exactly the kinds of challenges you're talking about. And I wish there was more acknowledgement of that among policymakers and the public, because it does present huge challenges for schools. And they need, in many cases, to have more resources than they have to make this work. Or they certainly need more creativity in trying to think of how you're going to honor this mandate, this democratic mandate. It's not easy, and there's sometimes when finally we realize that some kids just cannot make it in regular kinds of classrooms, and so we try and develop other means. Sometimes those are good and legitimate and are successful, and sometimes they're not so much, and they're troubling. But I think if we could just begin with a recognition of what it means to have your doors open to everybody, and to realize that often means that schools need more resources than they have, because, as you say, it can be a very challenging environment when you have some students who are, let's say, very disturbed or filled with rage and anger because of terrible things that have happened in their own lives, or have significant kinds of learning disabilities, right? So all of these different things demand the kinds of resources that sometimes schools don't get.
Is there reality in recent history that schools wasted the resources they were given? I sometimes find that the most curious thing of all, the notion that somehow enormous amounts of money have been wasted, and therefore we have to be exceedingly careful about directing funds towards education. I just wonder where that comes from. I mean, is there some grain of truth in that?
Sure. I mean, you show me any public or private institution, for that matter, where you don't find, you know, evidence of corruption or waste or mismanagement or foolishness. You know, it's sadly, it's just part of the landscape. And, you know, you can pick up the newspaper and find these cases of people who are milking the system with our schools out here in In California, there's a case of some superintendent of a small district who managed to finagle things so that he gets a paycheck larger than the president's. So there's that kind of corruption that exists, and yes, there's waste. And yes, there are boondoggles, if you will, and maybe that's the thing to look at, because as I said, in any large institution, any large organization, I mean, no matter what it is, whether it's the banking industry, the medical industry, schooling, you're going to find these cases of corruption and waste. And we do our best to try and put laws into place and try and put regulations into place to protect against it. And, you know, probably by and large, we're fairly successful, certainly so more so than a lot of other countries. But what's interesting to me is maybe this third leg here that we're talking about, and that is, it gets us back to the very beginning of our conversation, and that is the search for the kind of miracle cure, the thing that's going to do it. And sometimes we end up spending huge amounts of money on devices, different kinds of structures in school, techniques, approaches, curricula, or whatnot, that maybe we should have been a little more thoughtful about. I mean, right now there's the massive rush to get all kinds of technology into schools. That's hugely important. Of course we want our schools to be wired and to have good technology. In the Los Angeles Unified School District, there's been a big flap here because there's been this kajillion dollar attempt to get tablet computers in every student's hands. And a lot of people are complaining about the wastefulness of that. So it's those kinds of things that kind of get me thinking about maybe mismanaged funds, because if you think about it, it's not the magic bullet that's going to do it. It's not getting the tablet computer into the kids' hands that's going to make the difference. It's what kind of professional development do we have for teachers to enable them to use those devices in more effective ways? What kind of instruction are we providing for students? So again, what we tend to do is we tend to look at the magic cure rather than all the kind of human stuff that ought to be going around it. And I think that can lead to some spending that we look back on and shake our heads about.
I am reminded and have been reminded in many case points in our conversation about the quote sometimes attributed to Albert Einstein, but I think it's William Bruce Cameron, who said, "Not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts." And I think in our conversation we've talked a lot about some of the things that count that are not easily counted. And I think in many ways that's what your book's all about, getting us to think about those matters in education.
I love that quotation. Yeah, and I think it's so exactly right on. You know, how do you count a sense of community? How do you count falling in love? How do you count fairness? How do you count, you know, and the list goes on. How do you count all the so many of the things that really matter to us? There are things we can count, and we have to count them, and it's good to count them. But I think it's just such an error to think that everything is countable.
The book is Why School? Reclaiming Education for All of Us, published by the New Press, and its author, Mike Rose. Mike Rose, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. This was a real pleasure and honor for me.
That was great. Thank you so much for a wonderful interview.
The preceding interview with Mike Rose was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. Mike Rose went on to write the book When the Light Goes On, The Life-Changing Wonder of Learning in an Age of Metrics, Screens, and Diminished Human Connection, and also a book called Writer's Block, The Cognitive Dimension, Studies in Writing and Rhetoric. Mike Rose passed away in 2021 at the age of 77. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we look forward to the monthly visit of Dr. Art Sear, who will join us to offer his analysis and reflection on a number of different questions and topics. On Friday, Fern Schumer Chapman and a lovely book by her called Like Finding My Twin, she recounts the amazing but true story of her mother, who barely escaped the horrors of the Holocaust. She and her very best friend were separated from each other very shortly after landing here in North America. And it was more than 70 years before the two of them were reunited. The story of that amazing reunion is told in Fern.